out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday, the 29th of June, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we're actually going out live today for the first time in quite a while at radioarian.com on a Friday. As it's Friday, we're joined by Florian Geyer from Mysterium Fasces. Florian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just grand. Nice to be back on the first Daily Nationalist episode of the summer that I've appeared on. It's a little bit of a kind of typical rainy day out here on the west coast of North America, which is why we're doing it live for all of our listeners. But I think it'll be a good show as always.
Yeah, I'm very glad that you got up early enough in time to make this podcast. I think we've got a good one for the listeners. Just before we get into it, I just want to remind people that we have got prisoners of war. One of them was actually stabbed the other day in prison. So please do remember to write to them, and you can find all their details, all the prison addresses, at radioarian.com in the sidebar there where it says, please write to our prisoners of war. I just wanted to remind people of that before we get into this. And now on to the subject of today's podcast, which is the rather disgusting display of heathen idolatry that was Prince William at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem a couple of days ago. I really couldn't believe this. I mean, does the guy really take this seriously? Does he really think that that is actually a remnant of the Temple of Solomon? I mean, it quite clearly isn't. And this guy is supposed to be the head of the Anglican Church eventually, and yet here he is worshipping the Jews, basically. Did you see this, Florian, this Prince William at the Wailing Wall?
Oh, I'm only seeing the pictures coming out now. I mean, but indeed, as you say, this seems to be a pretty typical rite of passage, so to speak, for many of these international leaders to kind of get their chops in the Zionist entity. They have to go and do obeisance to the, as you say quite correctly, idolatrous so-called Wailing Wall.
Every one of them, isn't it? Every single one of these politicians or royalty, anyone that's anyone in the celebrity world, I guess, has to go and worship the Jews, show how much they love the Jews by pretending that this is somehow a remnant of Solomon's temple. And it's quite clear it isn't. And if you are a Christian, then there is no way on earth you could accept that that is a part of Solomon's temple, not even a part of Herod's temple, which is what it's more accurately should be referred to. I mean, we can just start by looking at the verses that actually refer to this from the New Testament. Matthew 24 says, and Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, see ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. So he's saying there, not one stone is going to be left of this temple. He doesn't just say it there. You've got Mark 13 as well, verse 1, where it says, and as he went out of the temple, one of his disciples saith unto him, Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here. And Jesus answering said unto him, seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Quite clearly it's saying here that the whole temple will be thrown down, and it was quite a magnificent edifice at the time, not really befitting the Hebrews and their God. Luke 21 continues, and it says, and as some spake of the temple, how it was adorned with goodly stones and gifts, he said, as for these things which ye behold, the days will come, in the which there shall not be left one stone upon another, that shall not be thrown down. And later on in that chapter, it says, "And when ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out. And let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. For there shall be great distress in the land, and a wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the nations until the times of the nations be fulfilled." So what it's, and all of that was fulfilled. You got the prophecy there. The whole temple is going to be destroyed. It warns about when the temple is going to be destroyed, when Jerusalem is compassed with armies. And that's what happened. And that is, it's not an article of Christian faith. That's what happened. I mean, all the history books say it was completely destroyed. There was nothing left. And if you're a Christian, then how can anyone believe that that is actually a remnant of the wall of the temple? Do you think that this is an actual wall of the temple, Florian, or do you think it's some kind of fake?
No, it's definitely a fake. This is a basic article of Christian faith. And there are so many different angles that we could approach it from. But suffice to say that the destruction of the Second Temple is the ultimate act, of sort of the end of the Old Testament age. I guess kind of the way that it's described, you can think about for our listeners, the destruction of the Second Temple or Herod's Temple by the Romans was the equivalent of kind of the destruction of the Pentagon and the World Trade Center, you know, at St. Peter's Cathedral, all rolled into one. It was really the symbolic center of the Old Testament Israelite life. And so if you're a Christian, there's no way that you cannot believe the words of our Lord and Savior as they're printed in the Gospels. I mean, he makes these extremely specific claims about the destructions of the temple in terms of the total destruction, not one stone left upon stone. We also know that the Romans were extremely intent upon destroying the very edifices of the Israelite state and the Israelite culture and nation, because they were done with their rebelliousness, and their heavy-handedness in terms of their reprisals is quite famous. But this is the whole of the Gospel of John is all about the temple. This is the whole point of the Gospel of John, is talking about how appropriate worship to God is not offered in temples made by human hands. It's made in temples created by the Holy Spirit in the hearts of men, that God is spirit and he has to be worshipped in spirit and truth. And there are all of these scenes and all of these allusions in the Gospel of John when Jesus is around the temple precincts, where you see these Pharisees and these temple attendants who have this dead faith, where they have the outwards, overt, cosmetic, aesthetic adherence to God and to his will, but in the interior life, their hearts are black. They don't turn towards God. They worship themselves. This is quite famously expressed in, you know, the publican and the Pharisee, where there's the Pharisees, "Thank you, God. I'm so great. Thank you for making me." And then the publican asks God to have mercy on him. And so the fact that the scriptures were even written before the destruction of the Second Temple is one of the key facts of the legitimacy of the Holy Scriptures. And it still even trips up liberal scholars, because they can't understand how you have some of these very early manuscripts, which were very certainly made before 70 AD when the Romans destroyed the temple, yet predict the temple's destruction extremely accurately, including with the description of the siege palisade that they would build around it in order to destroy it. So there's just no way, I mean, somebody can be a serious Christian and accept that this is the temple. Also, historically, it doesn't make sense, because we know for hundreds of years after the temple was destroyed, the Romans renamed the city to Aela Capitolina, and they barred Jews on pain of death from entering not into just Jerusalem, but all of Palestine. And there was a totally new Roman-style city built on top of the edifices upon the same spot.
Yeah, it's absolutely impossible that that can be part of Herod's temple. I believe there are actually prophecies about it in the Old Testament as well. I mean, this was a really important, pivotal point of the Christian faith, was that this temple was utterly destroyed and there was not one stone left of it upon another. So let's have a look at just how the Jews came to be telling everybody that this is a part of Solomon's temple. And this is taken from an article about the origins of the Wailing Wall. It says, There is no proof that the present site of the Jewish Wailing Wall in Jerusalem is any part of the temple that existed in the time of Herod and Jesus. In fact, the particular location that the Jewish authorities have accepted as being the temple is actually the western wall of an early Roman fortress, finally built and enlarged by Herod the baby killer. Herod called it Fort Antonia, after the famous Mark Antony, who lived at the end of the first century before Christ. Before 1520 AD, no Jew or Muslim was at all interested in the place. It had no significance for them because it was a Christian site that only Christians believed to be significant. It was actually a Christian dump that was of religious meaning to Christians alone. The pile of refuse at the spot was so huge, having accumulated for decades over the site by the deposits of the Christian women, that it finally became noticeable to the first Ottoman king who conquered Jerusalem, and that's Selim, the father of Suleiman the Magnificent. Since the garbage dump was so near a region where Selim had his palace, he inquired why the filthy area was there and who it was who maintained it. And we have a source of this story, or the author, is Eleazar Naaman Poa, and he's writing in the 17th century. And he says, in the days of the King Sultan Suleiman, nobody knew the location of the temple, so he ordered a search of Jerusalem to find it. One day, the man in charge of the search, who had already given up hope of discovering the true site of the temple, saw a woman coming, and on her head was a basket full of garbage and filth. "What is that on your head?" he asked. "Garbage," she said. "Where are you taking it?" "To such and such a place." "Where are you from?" "From Bethlehem." "And between Bethlehem and this place, are there no garbage dumps?" "We have a tradition that anyone who brings garbage and dumps it here is performing a meritorious deed." "This must be it," said the man. "It must be the site of the temple." And the captain ordered many men to clear out the garbage from that spot. The garbage which, because of the great time that had passed, had turned into earth at the bottom. And so he uncovered the holy place. He went and told the king, who rejoiced greatly, and ordered them to clear and sweep the place and wash the wall with rose water. So that's the first part of the story, is this son of Suleiman the Magnificent. He discovers this rubbish dump. He sends a man out to look at this rubbish dump. And what it doesn't actually tell you there is the rubbish was menstrual filth. It was, you know, women's waste that they were throwing at this dump. It was obviously something that the Christians didn't like. So they thought, well, maybe it must be the temple, I guess. But I do find it funny that all these Jews are going there now, and it was actually covered in menstrual filth at one time. And now you've got all these politicians going up to it and worshipping it and kissing it and putting their hands on it. It's absolutely disgusting.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a species of irony. You can see God's sense of humor there. I mean, Jesus was crucified on a garbage dump. I mean, that was what Golgotha was. And so it's no surprise that instead of worshiping the true conqueror of filth, so to speak, they worship the remnants of the filth itself.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's move on a little bit, and we get up to the time of Rabbi Isaac Luria, who was born in Jerusalem 1534 and died 1572 AD. And the Jewish custom, and for almost the previous 400 years, was actually to assemble at the eastern wall at the Gate of Mercy, which is at the Mount of Olives, and pray westwards towards the Dome of the Rock, so in a completely different place. They adored a balustrade that they thought was the western wall of the Holy of Holies, but Rabbi Luria changed this. He was the person who established what is called the Lurianic Kabbalah, a form of mystic Gnosticism, and he was one of the most powerful men in 16th century Judaism, with much influence throughout all of Judaism. His credentials center around the fact that he could identify the persons in unmarked graves through visions, dreams, and supernatural revelations, not at all through the application of sound historical or geographical methods. Luria's prestige is still extremely high among many religious Jews, because Luria was the first person in Jewish history, 450 years ago, to point out the present Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall, as the place to assemble for the Jewish people, and where they ought to worship God. No Jewish person had ever gone to the Wailing Wall before, until Luria told one Rabbi Abraham Halevi that if he went there, he would see the Shekinah, the divine presence. And from that time forward, Jews in Jerusalem began to flock to that former Christian holy spot, which the Muslims had cleaned up after they inherited it from the Christians, and the Jewish authorities soon turned it into what is now called the Wailing Wall. Well, I wonder what their official history of it is, but I mean, this seems to be what it is. I've heard of this Rabbi Isaac Luria before, the guy behind the Kabbalah. Do you know much about him, Florian?
No, unfortunately, I'm not an expert, no.
Yeah, he's, basically into the Kabbalah stuff. I mean, you can see right. That here, from visions, dreams, supernatural stuff. But we can go back before this as well to see where people have tried to find the temple. Because basically, I mean, if the Jews can say this is the temple, they can say, well, Christianity is a load of rubbish. All that stuff in the New Testament about the temple being destroyed, it wasn't destroyed. You know, this is what makes these politicians and these people that go there today into heretics for acknowledging that, especially the people that are supposedly part of the church. But we can go back further to look at when they first tried to find this place. And this is Julian the Apostate, Julian the hero of the pagans. And this is quite interesting. I took this from a Jewish report on him. Julian the Apostate was the last to try and rebuild the Jews' temple. And before his death, Julian appointed his friend and general Alypius to oversee the construction. According to the church father Gregory of Nazianzus, writing in Asia Minor within a year of the project, the Jews, quote, in large number and with great zeal, set about the work, close quote. Women contributed precious ornaments and carried dirt in their gowns. Another contemporary, Ephraim of Syria, a monk famous for his poetic hymns, reported that the Jews, quote, raged and raved and sounded the trumpets, and that all of them raged madly and were without restraint, close quote. Later Christian historians left similar descriptions. These Christian reports come from many different localities, and they clearly must contain a core of truth. Moreover, we have similar reports from pagan sources. But actual work on the temple probably lasted only a few days, however. Numerous reports, both pagan and Christian, attribute the work stoppage to a fire and perhaps an earthquake. The Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus reported that, quote, terrifying balls of flame kept bursting forth near the foundations of the temple, close quote, burning some of the workers to death and putting a stop to the enterprise. Gregory of Nazianzus wrote of a, quote, a furious blast of wind, close quote, and a flame that issued forth from the sacred place. Ephraim noted that there were winds, earthquakes, and lightning, and that, quote, a fire came forth, close quote. Well, this sounds like there were miracles going on and to actually prevent the Jews from rebuilding this place. There are other reports of Jews trying to escape from these fiery attacks, and one of them tried to touch the door handle of a church, and he was instantly zapped and executed. And all these reports, I mean, they don't just come from Christians, they come from pagans as well. Just the act of trying to rebuild the temple, it stirred up God's wrath in some way. I mean, you must have heard about what happened here when they tried to rebuild the temple, I would have thought, Florian.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's an extremely famous episode. And so, I mean, kind of going back to the idea of the temple as this great symbolic location for these Pharisees. I mean, we discussed before in this podcast the idea and the ancient world where symbolism was much more important, and it was an iconic window into a transcendental reality. And so the temple especially was considered to be an icon of heaven and earth. It was a reflection of the heavenly reality and its structure, even mathematically, in terms of its divinely pointed architectural ratios and so forth. And so the reality of the existence of the edifice of the temple was this huge, eminent bastion of prestige. It attested to the antique quality of the Judaic religion and their God. They were known to offer, be a priestly people, to offer sacrifices for all around, and there was lots of syncretic double worship of the God of the Israelites by many pagans. And so the destruction of that temple as judgment from God is kind of the ultimate sign, especially post-Constantine, of the reality and the triumph of Christianity. So the re-erection of that temple would invalidate those words which Jesus had spoken in the gospel, which were well known at this time. And the Jews understood this quite explicitly. And that's why we come back and we read the gospels, especially the gospel of John. It's all about the temple and about the spirit of God in the temple. And that's why the spirit of the temple veil rended in two inside the Holy of Holies to signify that the spirit of God, the Shekinah, had departed. And so in this particular instance, yeah, this is quite a famous story where the work was stopped because God sent fire and brimstone, essentially, from the depths of the earth to consume the workers. And the whole point is that the Jews, they desperately want to reconstruct their third temple, this last eschatological reality, which they believe is necessary in order to hearken the coming of, you know, their Messiah, which we know will be the Antichrist, to establish the worldwide physical kingdom of Israel on earth. So this is, and then this gets all wound up, and, you know, the Christian Zionist heresy, where some of these people are so deluded and so, you know, ensnared by the devil that they want to accelerate the construction of the third temple because they believe that that will trigger the return of Jesus Christ, which of course is like literally a satanic inversion from what the Orthodox Christian doctrine is, which is that the Messiah of the Jews will be the Antichrist and will rule from the third temple in Jerusalem. So that's essentially what this is all about, is it's the iconic representation of the temple and anti-temple archetype of Christ and Antichrist. Israel and Judah, so forth.
Yeah, you've got sort of evangelical accelerationists that want the Jews to build their temple so that the apocalypse comes. You know, it's quite bizarre. Well, let's have a look at Julian the Apostate and his reasons for actually doing this, because I found this particularly interesting. And again, this is quoting from a Jewish source. Some scholars argue that Julian's temple project was undertaken out of genuine friendship for his Jewish subjects, and that Julian is thus rightly regarded as a philo-Semite. But the principal motive for Julian's temple project was not just friendship towards Jews and Judaism, or even hostility towards Christianity. The rebuilding of the Jewish temple was an important part of a comprehensive reform of traditional paganism. Julian's supposedly anti-Christian actions are best understood as aspects of this reform. From Julian's syncretistic pagan perspective, the Jewish God was one of his own. In letters to his fellow pagans, he wrote of the Jews' ardent devotion and obedience to the law, and praised their God as most powerful and most good. Elsewhere, he referred to the God of the Jews as the Most High God, the Creator. For Julian, the God of the Jews is worshipped by us also under other names. More specifically, Julian identified the Jewish God as the universal demiurge. And then I added this bit, the aborted God creature of the Gnostics. The fact that Jews have a different name for their God was not a problem, as the syncretism of the Neoplatonists allowed for various names for the same God. Julian referred to the demiurge elsewhere by such names as Helios and Attis. Well, I think this is interesting for two reasons. One, because Judaism was part of traditional paganism. And two, because it makes it really clear that nobody thought the Christian God was the same God as the God of the Jews. And he's saying here that Julian is saying he worships the Jewish God. The Jewish God is one of his own. And that is quite clear that in the 4th, 5th century, There was no confusion over the two. There was no idea that the Christians were worshipping a Jewish God. The Jewish God was something quite separate, and he was seen as a God of the pagans, which I think, and this is coming from the Jews themselves, from a Jewish source. And Julian the Apostate is held up as, you know, as a bit of a hero by the pagans because he was going against Christianity, but he was quite clearly in the Jewish camp and saw the pagans as being in the same camp as him. Were you aware of this before, Florian?
I was not aware of his philo-Semitism, but certainly his religious attitude is not surprising whatsoever. I mean, the Roman tendency was to integrate and syncretize with religions that they could understand and which were useful to them. And so for Julian's purposes, you know, the Jews, of course, wielded economic and political power even then, and we have lots of early Christian records about you know, local Jewish merchants and magnates stirring up persecutions against the church and so forth. So, I mean, the Jews could be a powerful ally to Buffett and to support his imperial rule because they shared the same enemy, that is to say, the Christians. But this is one of the interesting things is that, from the very early period, there was the immense volatile dispute over this issue because the Jews certainly believed that all of the Christians had engaged in apostasy by worshiping the man Jesus as God the Most High, whereas the Christians, because they believed that the Jews rejected the Messiah, God in the flesh, did believe that they also were apostates because they did not reject God Himself who had come to them. And so this is, if you read, say, Justin Martyr, he's arguing with these pagans that no, Christianity is actually, it's not a new religion. It has taken over the correct, the liturgical and ecclesiastical mantle from the Old Testament Jews. He was making an argument that it's not a new religion. And so the whole division here is basically in terms of legitimate succession. That is the problem. And so it's a pretty zero-sum game, certainly in the ancient world, and they understood this very precisely and correctly, which is, you know, why Christian Zionism is such an absurdity. But absolutely, I was not aware, though, that Julian was such an intense philo-Semite. It doesn't surprise me, though. It's quite another bit of strong irony.
And it's quite bizarre you bring up there about them worshipping Jesus as a god, and they were against that. I mean, one of the accusations against Jesus in the Talmud is that he worshipped a brick. Apparently, he set up a brick and he worshipped a brick. And what are the Jews doing today with their Wailing Wall? You know, they're worshipping a pile of bricks. Doing exactly what they accused Jesus of. But we could go back even further. I mean, I've called that temple before. I've called it a pagan temple. And this is the reason why I would call it a pagan temple. I mean, you can get this bit from Wikipedia. Herod's temple. The second temple was originally a rather modest structure constructed by a number of Hebrew exiles from the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, returning to the Levant from Babylon under the Achaemenid appointed governor Zerubbabel. However, during the reign of Herod the baby killer, the second temple was completely refurbished and the original structure was totally overhauled into something almost unrecognizable from what had been there before. So this temple that was destroyed, I mean, it wasn't the Hebrews' temple. Anyway, it was Herod's temple. This is why it was all rebuilt and why it was all ornate and why the disciples were pointing to it and saying, look at this thing it's all ornate over there. What do you make of it? And Jesus is saying, well, it's going to be destroyed. And Herod didn't just rebuild this temple. He didn't just knock down the original temple and put his own one in its place. But he even started appointing his own priests as well. Priests from his own tribe, from the Edomite tribe, not from the tribe that should be there, from the tribe of Levi. You can look back at the records, and he was appointing a different priest pretty much every 6 months to run this place, and he'd taken over the whole of the establishment. And I think there's a reference to this in Matthew 24, in verse 15. It says, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." And that's the same wording there that Jesus was using, saying flee into the mountains earlier in that other gospel. And these priests that Herod put in place, I mean, that's the abomination of desolation that's standing in the holy place. I think it might even be another reference about Satan being in the holy place. And at that time, people are going to need to run as well. I can't understand really any reverence even for this temple because it's built by Herod. That's why it was destroyed. And no Christian should have any reverence whatsoever for the Western Wall or for Herod's temple. They're all apostates and heretics that do think that, I think. Florian, have you got anything else that you'd like to add about this second temple or this verse in Matthew 24?
Yeah, well, mostly that the abomination of desolation is when the priests of the temple do not worship God, worship an idol in place of God within the temple. So whether that's, sort of a fertility cult of Demeter or Dionysius, or if that's, you know, the raw ego of the priests or the rulers within, that is the meaning of defilement. So it's our call to, as much as we possibly can in these degenerate, filthy times, to keep our own temples of our hearts free from idolatry and paganism and slavery to passions and sins and foreign gods.
Definitely, and I hope today's podcast has given listeners lots of ammunition they can use when they're discussing the Wailing Wall with people. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Florian. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back on Monday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.